This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're celebrating 30 years on air with The Poet and the Poem, and we're celebrating today with Philip Nikolaev. He's from Boston, originally from Russia, and here he is with an opening poem.
Eagles. Two eagles circled over Cambridge today, a rare sight, lovely, against the chalkboard sky. Drawn to stare, I soon noticed that they went around in near-perfect circles at even speed. In fact, they looked exactly identical. Their widespread wings didn't so much as flutter. I heard a thin electrical whiz and wondered if they carried tiny surveillance cameras on board that could scan Shakespeare and the Pathos of Rambling that I was reading.
Philip Nikolaev came to America in 1990 to study at Harvard University, and he is the editor of Fulcrum, which is an annual periodical, which is the premier edition of poetry, philosophy, and aesthetics in America today. How did you do that? You, a Russian-born person, came over here and stuck your hand right in the middle of American poetry.
It happened, well, as luck would have it, I might say. It so happens that I, even though I started out as a Russian poet a really long time ago, I grew up bilingual, and on coming to the States, I became an American poet primarily, and became immersed in the current literary situation, as it were. So the idea to start a magazine was there for a long time, and finally, eventually, it materialized. And that's the brief answer.
And we know that a person who puts out a magazine of 500-plus pages a year sacrifices a lot of his own personal energy to other poets. So today we would like to give you some of that back and hear Philip Nikolaev and your own poetry. This is a new book, Letters from Aldenderry, and we're going to hear more from it now.
This is a diptych, two poems called Thunders. Each part is about a different kind of thunder, you might say. Thunders. 1. Throughout the music-colored sky and visible land, swift alternation of night and day, with more blinding crashes per minute, per minute, per minute. Tonight they really mean it up there and are gonna make a big racket for fully a couple of hours, across rain hanging in strobe tatters. Car alarms go off in the thunder, and the photosensitive lighting of the parking lot keeps coming on and off and on and off, weakling competitor to the sky. All windows stay fast unlit. Electricity wells, smells, and clangs a thousand bells. In the middle of this mess, absolutely and temporarily free, a poet on the balcony smokes into the sky, grateful that he couldn't sleep. 2. At the playground with Sophia at 6:30 p.m., an F-15 fighter jet flew by low. Nowadays they sometimes do that on purpose, sending off a shockwave of sound and fury through the streets, triggering car alarms at the said parking lot. Once the air blast passed, the playground filled with the weaker alarms of stunned children, the sandbox sounding the most desperate.
Philip Nikolaev, I'm Grace Cavalieri, we're at the Library of Congress together, and he is married to the poet Katia Kapovich, whom we've met here at the library and have always remembered the work of both of these poets. Philip has written four books of poetry. The one I read first was his third book, and it was called Monkey Time. It won the 2001 Verse Award, which was a publication award. Now we have Letters from Aldenderry. And do you have a feeling of a difference between these two books?
Yes, there's a similarity and also a difference. The similarity lies in the fact that in both books, what you have is a selection of work written over a really long period of time, about 12 years or so. But these two respective selections were made at different times. And when I selected Monkey Time, I had a somewhat different sensibility, which has then changed, and the poetry has changed, and I'd written a fair amount in addition to older work. So, there's a difference, I guess, in...
What is the sensibility difference? What is your change?
Oh, well, it boils down to specific poems always. I don't know. It's not very easy to categorize. But when you put a book together from a large body of work, it's like a musical sensibility, is how you play it. And so when I was putting together Letters from Aldenderry, I just played it by ear, and this is what's come out.
So let's hear some more of what has just come out. Philip Nikolaev.
I'll read a poem called The Art of Forgetting. Last night I cooked my socks in the microwave by a mistake. What to do when you're so absent-minded? Oh, well, I have frequently refrigerated my poems in the freezer to the point of having to thaw them later, and poetry is what emerges in defrosting. I have also lost to nature generations of galoshes, coats, scarves, umbrellas, even once an Egyptian skullcap, whose individual names I forget. The name of the czar escapes my mind, on whom was meant to be my dissertation, or was it thesis? Water, all kinds of water under the all-purpose bridge. If I've forgotten so much via absent-mindedness mostly, then how much have we forgotten as a species? One day we learn, another forget, everything, including this fact. It's possible, given enough time and effort, to forget anything, which is why we like to reminisce sometimes on those even who've decided they don't like us. We'll fight for our memories, the truth as it appeared once. But to remember something, we need to forget something, a different truth. My grandmother believed that if you dab any convenient spot on your body with iodine daily, it will help you keep your memory in old age. Head of the Marxism-Leninism chair at the Ivanova Energy Institute, where she taught philosophy and scientific atheism, she was the kindest soul, loved and spoiled me to distraction, and her blueberry cakes were, of course, the best in this world. Baptized as a child, on her retirement to a small apartment in the Crimea, she read the Bible, perestroika raging all around. Everyone wrote, thought, and talked of Stalin, 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 Beria, Stalin. She read the Bible, both the Testaments. Thus dialectical materialism was forgotten, and an ancient faith recovered. I too would like to forget a few things, keep trying, but tend to forget instead all the wrong ones, like submitting payments by the due date, the need to tie my shoestrings. Mnemosyne and her daughters the muses, and her grandsons the museums. Literature too is a museum, as well as Lenin's mausoleum, which is essentially a tomb. As you must of course know, I've forgotten the remote control on the bathroom sink, where my reflection in the crooked mirror distracted me with its scowl. This is Earth life, but like hailing from outer space. When my daughter was born, I spent the night with her and my wife at the hospital and went home the next day to clean the apartment. I vacuumed the floor very thoroughly, my thoughts soaring far and wide. Little did I notice that the vacuum was running in blowout mode, so the condition of the floor changed hardly at all. This still makes my wife laugh and may indeed be worth remembering against all death. While stress, duress, and strain, the painful neck crane, and other stuff rotten, are best forgotten.
Philip Nikolaev, we're celebrating 30 years of life on air with Philip today. And the poet and the poem is very, very proud to have him here. This book is from Salt Press from the UK. And if I said he was a lyrical poet, I could prove it to you. If I said narrative, futuristic, philosophical, anecdotal, I could prove it. What do you make of that?
Oh, Grace, you have such innate charm that I have no doubt that you could prove anything about my poems. Yes, I do. I do have a, you might say, a genuinely eclectic sensibility in poetry, and I like to think that there is a unifying something, a unifying voice, perhaps, in all these different poems. But it's true that they're in different genres, and they come naturally to me, so they just come out that way.
I know now why I called you an original. I'm not the only one, of course. But it is, I said today when we presented you in a public reading, that you write as if no one is watching. That is the greatest compliment I could pay. You don't show off for anyone. You don't adhere to trends. You don't care what you spoof or what you take apart. You just say what you want. Where did you get that?
I don't know. It's all. First of all, when I first started writing poems, and I was very little at the time. I think I started scribbling at age 7, perhaps, in Russian. And for a long time, it developed into a sort of habit. I didn't show my poems to anyone until I was a teenager. I had a notebook of poems, but it was a private matter to me, and it still largely continues to be a private exercise, mm-hmm. a private activity that is the one that matters to me most. So I needed to professionalize, and I eventually developed into what you call a professional poet. But the writing process has not changed very much.
For a teenager writing poetry in Russia, was that something that was valued, that you could show a friend and they could say, he's not a weirdo?
Well, among my friends, yes, there was no problem with that. It's a respected activity, and especially at the time in Russia, we're talking about the Soviet years. For many people, the arts, and poetry in particular, were the vitamin that they needed in the totalitarian system. It was really an escape from the day-to-day politics. I grew up, with a lot of indoctrination going on around me at school and elsewhere, and poetry was a way to find oneself, to withdraw from all that and to focus on some form of inner contemplation or some such.
And it saved your soul.
That's still an open question, but I hope that it contributes toward that.
Philip Nikolaev, we're at the Library of Congress. Please read us from your new book, Letters from Aldenderry, and we found out today that Aldenderry is not a geographic place.
It might be, for all I know, but I made up the place name, and I've noticed that lately I've been asked a lot about what it means, what is Aldenderry, and the short answer is that it's just a place of the mind.
Hmm.
But I hope that reading the book will justify the title, so I don't want to belabor. I'll read a poem. It's called Eternal City, which is the title of a painting by an extremely close friend of mine. His name is Samuel Garriginian. And to me, he is the greatest artist alive, perhaps. I'm deeply moved by his paintings. Eternal City is... he lived in Armenia when he started working on this painting, and then he emigrated to the United States and continued working on it here. As he was watching the capital of Armenia, Erevan, which was afflicted by the war, Erevan had some wonderful gardens that were destroyed for firewood at the time of the Karabakh War in Armenia. So it's really a poem about him and about this painting. And I just want to say that his work can be seen online at samuelg.com, www.samuelg.com. And those are wonderful paintings. I can't recommend them highly enough. Eternal City for Samuel Garriginian. He who says that in art one finds not the object, but its myth, himself stands monastically thin and looks like his own self-portrait, the same eye staring out at you, marking your silhouette against the wall, or posture at table with its wild precision. He needs so few things that he has got rid of the chairs in his studio for want of space, and stands for hours as he finishes Dionysus' hairy thigh or the nymph's coy hand still on the hefty shoulder. When out of his window in war-torn Armenia, he gazed at the ruins of Erevan's tall gardens, reduced to firewood, he understood that to revive a place, one must, by an effort of the soul, rebuild it from scratch. So he painted his eternal city over 3 years in several apartments. First there, then here, and I am now bound to roam it forever, a myth impossible to exit. When he went to real Rome, he didn't like it, although he did shudder at the sight of aesthetic treasures long photographed by his heart to the obscurest detail. He says there was too much food and it was too good, a distraction for the mind, which must be hungry. A feast once in a while is okay, but Europe doesn't need any more beauty. Now an artist can live only in America.
Philip Nikolaev has had poetry in many journals, such as the Paris Review, Grand Street, Harvard Review, the Boston Globe, Verse, many, many magazines across the English-speaking world. And he's anthologized in 180 More Extraordinary Poems for Every Day out of Random House. You speak several languages. You write only in English. I cannot get over this. You know so many words. You know so many English words. Do you just absorb them like a sponge? Is it just a special neuron you have? It's like Nabokov, who knew so many words that I had to look up, being American-born, and I had to stop reading his work and look one up in the dictionary. How do you explain this?
Oh, perhaps a biological predisposition. I don't know. It just comes naturally to me.
I agree. I think you're just able to learn languages. Some people are just born able. It's easy for you.
It is easy for me to learn languages. I learn them faster than most people. I've learned them fast in the past as the need arose. I forget them just as easily, so it doesn't necessarily mean that I retain them for a long time. But then again, it's easy to remember afterwards.
You have had your hand on many an American poet since you've been here, and you consider yourself an American poet, which we do too. You must have a sense of where you are in the stream of work being presented and committed today. Where do you think you are?
That's an interesting question. It does occur sometimes to me, to myself, to ask where I stand in the American literary scene, and I feel that I don't, maybe I never ponder it long enough to really figure out the answer. My style changes a lot. It's changed dramatically over the years, and I don't really feel like I belong in any particular corner. I'm sort of scattered all over the place.
You are an amalgam of yourself. You're not afraid to put a sonnet inside of a prose poem. You're not afraid to use idiomatic English. You're not afraid to use street language, even expletives. You are not afraid to speak of classics. You just do whatever the hell you want. And so keep on.
But why would anyone be afraid of any of those things?
Oh, public opinion. Have you heard of public opinion?
You see what you're saying.
That's what you're clean of. Mm-hmm. Okay, Philip is here. I'm Grace, and we're together. We are celebrating today, and he's helping us. Let's have another.
Now, this one is about what a terrible child I was when I was little. When I was about 4 and later at 5 and 6 years of age, I did something terrible to my parents. I would run away from home for a whole day, and being a sort of contemplative type from early on, I would forget myself and would not remember that it's time to go home until it was dark at sunset. So this poem is about that. It's called Tendency Toward Vagrancy. I've long had what Soviet psychiatrists called a tendency toward vagrancy. At 4, I would run away from home repeatedly for a whole day, alone and sometimes with a friend named Boris, of like age. Knew full well we just can't do this, but nudge for nudge and wink for wink, we'd board the trolleybus number 10, I think, buy tickets at 4 kopecks each from our gleanings and savings of the week, stick them into the ticket punch on the wall, watch the Chad fall as you pulled, and ride all across Kishinev in half an hour to get off near that unforgettable restaurant built in the likeness of a huge wine barrel. We peered inside. It was cool. Then we had options. Go and splash in the local artificial lake. I couldn't swim yet. Wander in between along the banks, catching frogs to take home in a glass jar to populate a small construction pond. Why did we always use my shirt to do this? Or go and explore the local flea market, which was not at all safe to do. But even at 4, it's nice to have options. One guy sold what we thought was a gun. We asked him and he confirmed it. Those were days of cholera epidemics in Moldova. We'd buy peasant-cooked fodder corn on the cob when we got hungry, haggled with old ladies over pennies. We wouldn't catch the return trolley until sunset. Then it's always the same picture. The wicket creaks open, the landlord's mutant barks through froth. My wet shirt clings. I step out of the dark toward my mother waiting by the door of our temporary house on Kaluga Street, which was a bit of a dirt road, probably still is. She has been crying, takes me inside. Room and kitchen, no bathroom or running water. The room had a brick stove, the kitchen a dirt floor, with mice and sometimes grass. And a white washstand. These lines are all that has survived of them. There was great beauty in their squalor. She has been crying, takes me inside, says she will scold me later. I know it will be soon. First she must call the cops to tell them I've been found. Of course, back then I didn't understand anything, neither how a poet harms his mother, nor how alienated. Thank you, Marx, for that term. One can be, from the start, and free, in the grip of that greatest paradox of all, a happy Soviet childhood.
That's a lovely, ironic ending, and I think probably mostly true. I like the where the poem turns a corner when you re-enter the house and your wet shirt clings. That's a very important moment because it shifts the reality from where you've been to where you're going, but it's a photographic shift.
Mm-hmm.
So that you think cinematically, I say that. And just that moment of the wet shirt, if we were doing it with a camera and saw this little boy with a wet shirt mm-hmm. walking in, it says quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Did your grandmother live to see you published?
She lived to see me published in Russian, yes, but not in English, I don't think.
You were the shining star in her heart.
My grandmother's? Mm-hmm. Yes, she loved me dearly.
I can tell. You know, you can always tell a man who is really adored by a mother or grandmother.
Now, how do you tell?
They're just comfortable in their own skin with women, really.
I see.
And this is psychobabble time, but I'm a grandmother.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I just am terrified of missing out on anything. So I'm so glad that she got to see you as a man.
Fascinating. I learn a lot from you, Grace. Yeah, I'll keep this well in mind.
And your mother, would you say you had a middle-class existence by Russian standards? I mean, a dirt floor isn't something you'd find in America.
No, this was early on. When I was seven, we finally, you know, between the ages of 3 and 7, we lived in this really strange house in Chisinau, Moldova. I was born in Moscow, but when I was little, we moved to Moldova.
They were intellectuals, your parents?
They were intellectuals. My father was a translator, an interpreter, and a linguist, and my mother worked as an editor, but their salaries were small, mm-hmm. and we were in a new place. So we were, I think, renting the Russian term is, Vremyanka, is a temporary house, as I called it in the poem, just because we knew that we were living there temporarily for only about 4 years. And then we moved to another apartment and we bought a black and white TV. So our existence became more middle class by Soviet standards, I guess, somewhat middle class. We were Soviet intelligentsia, that was the term of art.
I understand, and we will look forward to the memoirs that are going to fill in the edges of that. I'm going to dog you about that.
Uh-huh.
Let's have some more poetry. We're premiering Letters from Alden Derry from Salt Press, and you can probably Google that and find out where to get this book. It's been heralded by great, very great critics in America, including Marjorie Perloff, and she says that this is truly exciting, a collection of lyrics as surprising and varied as it is original. And that's the operative word.
I'll read a poem called Pyromania. Whatever happened to the childproof flighter? I don't see them on counters anymore, but I remember that day in 1995 that I bought my first, since Nini's Corner didn't carry the normal kind, and on a midnight subway ride across Boston, tried to figure out how to use it, but couldn't. This ticker read in terse verse, to operate push button in and up, rotate spark wheel, push down on lever. But I saw no button. The spark wheel kept firing into the void until eventually a heavily stoned good-natured fellow from across the aisle volunteered to help me. He said, hey, I done seen this shit before, let me try, and pointed out the safety button, cached shyly on the back of the activation lever, then asked if I had a pen on me. Surprised but professional, I produced a pen, and he used the ballpoint expertly to pry and rip out the disabling button. Try it now, he said. I did. The damn thing exploded in our face, singeing our eyebrows.
And that is a poem, an epitaph, because you've stopped smoking.
Yes, I have smoked. I haven't smoked a cigarette this year. It's a big departure for me.
It is, and that's excellent. So that poem has memorialized something mm-hmm. very important. Let's have another.
Mm. I feel nostalgic for the Laters, though.
I'm sure. Mm. I'm sure. And the funny thing you said about that is that you couldn't figure out how it worked, but any kid could do it. Are they just naturally inquisitive?
I think it's just that children's minds work differently from those of adults. I saw a study on TV when they gave those childproof lighters to a bunch of kids, and they instantly, it took them minutes to figure out how to light them. But then they asked adults, can you light this? And they had no clue.
They were adult-proof lighters.
Right. Children just do it by trial and error. They just keep doing a lot of different things, and eventually they manage. I'll read a poem called Nostalgia. As Grace, I was telling you earlier today, this was inspired, in a sense, by a poetry reading I gave a long time ago with an Irish poet who, after the reading, when we were having drinks, he said, so you're doing the Russian nostalgia thing over again. For what it's worth, this is my reflection on the theme. Nostalgia. Good thing we no longer write poems about a red skimmer dragonfly alighting on a poem, ignoring the true autobiographical fact, nor about anything good that we have done. Autobiography no longer saves. The old masters, they savored every comprimé of pain and painkiller. It near killed all of them, with the exception of those that it killed. They died the death of unfulfilled nostalgia. Now we have innovation, a novel preciousness and pride, a fresh method of feeling good or at least better about ourselves. It too no longer saves, but it no longer kills us either, does it?
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our guest is Philip Nikolaev. I'm Grace Cavalieri.